You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll learn about the life and legacy of civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer, a pivotal figure in the movement to register Black Americans to vote during the 1960s. Now, the number of people quitting their jobs has remained at record levels. In August alone, more than 4 million people quit their jobs. That's close to 3% of the entire workforce, according to the U.S. Labor Department. Our next guest has been looking at what this trend looks like for workers in all kinds of industries, including retail stores and restaurants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or someone close to you? Have you or someone you know quit during the pandemic? If so, what drove that decision? Do you think raising wages will help with worker shortages? Do we have to make jobs better in fields like the restaurant industry or retail? If you are trying to keep people hired or hire new people, what is it looking like from your perspective? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alina Selyuk is a business correspondent at NPR. Alina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Good. Well, this I'd heard anecdotal stuff about a lot of people quitting their jobs. This is not just anecdotes, right? The data is there. A lot of people are quitting.
It is there, and it has been there month after month after month. I specifically follow retail, for example, and every month when these reports from the Labor Department come out showing, you know, the rates of people quitting, every month I'm looking to see, is this going to be another record? And every month so far, for the last 3 months, we've been seeing all-time highs for both the rate and the number of people quitting retail jobs. But this is affecting a lot of industries. It's what's the term? The great resignation. That's kind of what we're living through, for sure.
I call it the quitting. I hope that catches on.
Quitting?
Yeah.
It's darker. It's darker.
It is. Now, the retail industry, it is one of the industries, as you point out, that's seen, it's not the only one, but it's seen big levels of people resigning. What is it? You've talked to people in retail. What is driving them out?
It's kind of fascinating. Retail, historically, I mean, if you think about it, sort of culturally has been considered this, you know, temporary bridge, this job that folks take, and sort of culturally has been treated as this place where you go in between, quote unquote, something better. And what data has shown over the years is that in reality, these are jobs that people return to over and over and over, in many cases over the course of many decades, different ages, different stages of their lives. And what I think COVID did, this past pandemic, it created, well, one retail worker put it, it took an untenable situation and made it even more untenable. It added so much more stress. These workers who were in many cases earning some of the lowest wages in the area, minimum wage jobs typically, were suddenly on the front lines of the pandemic. We've heard these stories that, you know, that people were making $14, $15 an hour, were essential. They were getting quote unquote hero pay. They were getting these bonuses for continuing to work while what much of the country sort of hunkered down during the peak of the pandemic. And many of them spent months doing that and then burnt out. I mean, it's as simple as that. That's what a lot of people say, is that it was too scary for them to keep working. They got burnt out. And then at some point they thought to themselves, why am I doing this? And then flip it all on its head to the point where now we're having this conversation about these job mismatch, these massive amounts of job openings that are out there. There are other options all of a sudden for folks. There are many other options for folks, maybe who don't have a college degree, maybe who have some college but didn't finish it, who have only worked in retail. There are just so many other jobs out there that they're thinking to themselves, maybe I'll try to do that instead. I don't have to stay. So the sort of the power dynamic shifted ever so slightly. I don't want to be presenting it like the labor dynamic shifted completely, but it's seeing a change.
I want to share an example from your reporting. A former grocery store cashier in Oregon named Rachel Baker. Here's what Rachel told you about the challenges at her job during the pandemic.
I actually found myself kind of holding myself at ready position for every time a customer left to the next customer and be like, okay, is this one going to blow up at me?
And that's part of the additional challenge, apart from the health risk of the pandemic itself, the added stress, stressed out customers, people maybe having to enforce mask mandates for the customers in the store. That for some, like Rachel, who I guess I gather went into another line of work, that was kind of a last straw too, right?
That was it. And remember, this is take you back last year, there were shortages of very basic items. So folks who were coming to shop to her store were also sort of at the end of the rope in many cases. They were quite stressed out, and all of that was coming out onto her. And she's fairly used. I mean, she'd been a cashier for many years, and so she was used to sort of de-escalating these situations. But the constant stress really took a toll. She had a bit of a breakdown and was like, I can't do this anymore. And realized that she kind of looked back and shocked herself, realizing how many years she did last. She didn't intend to stay in the job, but she stayed for a while because it was okay and it paid okay, but suddenly it just wasn't worth it. The line, it's not worth it, I don't think I've heard as much as I did this year from workers and restaurants and stores.
We're talking to business correspondent from NPR, Alina Selyuk, looking at people quitting, lots of people quitting in recent months in the United States, quitting their jobs, moving into new lines of work. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, and your experiences. If you are thinking about leaving a job, have left a job, have had trouble hiring people, and especially people who work in retail or in restaurants, we're going to get to in just a moment. How did things change for you at your work in the last year and a half? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alina, let's head into the restaurants now, another industry you've been following closely, one we know a lot of people have been quitting in. Similar stories there, I imagine, from what you heard in retail?
Fairly similar. A lot had to do with this sort of return of the customers, especially the servers, the folks who actually interact with people who come to eat. That was the big story a few months ago. I'm sure you've seen it, and it's happened, and it was just all over the place, where customers would come in and would expect kind of normal procedure, normal rates of operation at restaurants that were just barely reopening and had skeleton staff, and people were just rude. So that added up on top. I want to actually talk a little bit about wages, because as much as stress of the COVID sort of became the catalyst, the underpinnings of concerns that workers have voiced had been there for years, and that it's all about the wages in most cases. It's the top priority. There are other issues, benefits and sort of the structural workplace issues, but wages are at the top of the list for most people. And specifically at restaurants and bars, also retail and restaurants and bars, wages had stagnated for decades. And not until this year, 2021, did wages actually start kind of growing faster, actually gaining for both. So just to give you an example, for restaurants and bars, an average hourly wage for a worker who's not a supervisor is currently, latest data is for April, $15.76. It crossed the $15 threshold for the first time in May. It, overall, in leisure and hospitality, that $15 threshold got crossed for an average hourly wage, got crossed in April. For retail, currently, average wage is a bit over $18 an hour. So these wages had stagnated. And now that there's this quote unquote shortage, but really a job mismatch, many of the major companies are starting to look at that and reconsider it. But that was a major issue for a lot of folks in restaurants and bars.
Again, I want to hear from someone you talk to. This is Lamar Cornett, a restaurant worker in Kentucky who'd worked in the industry for more than 20 years and was rethinking it. Here's a listen.
I genuinely can't remember a single break that I've ever taken that lasted longer than the time it takes to use the bathroom or smoke a cigarette. I've never sat down to eat a meal. I've never had health insurance. I was working what I decided was going to be my last kitchen job.
I understand Lamar ended up staying in restaurants at a different job with better pay and benefits. But did you hear a lot of that story from restaurant workers?
Yes, 100%. On top of wages, you take sort of that wage that's quite difficult to support a family on, or even yourself. And then you add in just the stresses of doing kitchen work, which is what he's saying. Breaks are difficult. Schedules are chaotic. And some workers complained about really aggressive bosses. Some of these stories do overlap with retail, where you do also hear quite a bit about the chaotic or sort of just haphazard scheduling and unreliable scheduling is also a major concern.
We're talking to Alina Selyukh, business correspondent at NPR, with us today to talk about why we continue to see people quitting their jobs in record numbers over the last few months. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your job in the last year and a half? Have you quit a job or retired earlier than you were planning to? You are not alone, if so, and we'd love to hear your story. Are you having trouble hiring people? And in those jobs, the restaurants, the hospitality industry, retail, what would it take to make conditions there better? Were you fed up by the time the pandemic hit? Was it a last straw for you? Or would higher wages fix the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at why so many people are quitting their jobs during the pandemic, especially in the last few months. The latest data from the U.S. Labor Department says the numbers were at record highs in August. Alina Selyukh with NPR stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with what's being called the Great Resignation, or as some call it, the quitting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alina, we've heard from a couple people on Facebook. Lisa writes, I've switched to gig work and I love it. Is that one of the outlets you're finding people go to, leaving the steady job to go into gig work, consulting, that sort of thing?
Yes, that's for many people, that's the first opportunity. It's the easiest opportunity to enter. It has its own issues and concerns. Right. It has its own worries and financial considerations. It's kind of, I also want to point out actually something else about what we know where people are going, which is we don't actually know when people quit where they go. So that's something important to point out. So when we're looking at these numbers of folks quitting, whether it's retail or restaurants, the same set of data doesn't track them. We don't know if, and I have experienced this, I've talked to a number of people who did this. Some people quit a job in retail and take a different job in retail. Some people quit a job in a restaurant and go work at a store. So this kind of the switch we don't actually see through the data. And it is potentially growing that, we're seeing that people are getting hired still into these retail jobs. I think in August, the number was something like 900,000 people got hired into retail. So people are still taking these jobs. The bigger question is just sort of historically where, will this actually shift how much companies steal workers from each other and compete on the basis of better benefits, better scheduling, better pay.
On that note, we heard from Dave on Facebook who writes, I know two people who quit and found new jobs because they got better pay and benefits as new employees. Are we seeing a lot of, you just mentioned people raiding workers from other workplaces. Is this common? We're gonna give you a bonus. We're going to give you better benefits, whatever it takes to lure you over here.
That's exactly what's happening right now. Definitely in the sort of minimum wage, low wage work, companies are throwing all kinds of bonuses at first time signups. There is a big wave of wage increases, at least in major retail chains and restaurant chains. In some cases, we are still talking a couple of dollars, but for millions of people, that's actually pretty life changing. There is another really interesting thing to point out that there might be a fair amount of geographic mismatch that's happening. So when people bring up this idea that, well, there are so many jobs available. There are over, I think, 10 million jobs available, unfilled as of August. So there are actually more available jobs than unemployed workers. But I think we're seeing a major geographic mismatch in that, a job might be in Maryland and you live in Wisconsin or vice versa.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Troy in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. I think it's, I don't really have a lot of empathy for a lot of these business owners that are, a lot of these capitalists that are saying, they're complaining that they can't, you know, a lot of workers are leaving. They don't have, they can't find good workers. Well, this is kind of biting them in the butt for the last 30 years because they don't really pay a lot for these jobs. They haven't increased their wages. Their benefits have actually gotten worse, especially in Wisconsin. And I kind of feel like people that have really good paying jobs with benefits, they haven't been leaving those jobs. It's the people that they've kind of made these jobs disposable by not offering it, making it attractive to workers. So when the pandemic hit, these people are like, why would I go back to this job when I can do something I really want to do, you know, and pursue a career, maybe go back to college? Why would I go back to a job that can't even barely pay me minimum wage when it's disposable? They're everywhere. Those jobs are everywhere. Yeah, that's my comments.
Troy, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Alina, you mentioned wage stagnation over the last bunch of years. How about that feeling of being disposable? Is that something you heard from the workers you talked to who were leaving or thinking about leaving their jobs?
I mean, what the caller just said is sort of a short summary of most of my interviews with people who have quit. So yes, feeling disposable, feeling kind of, you know, cog in the machine was somebody called themselves. And again, this environment in which there is sort of a big, you know, almost societal psychological reconsideration of your own self and your role in the, you know, your family, perhaps, if you have, you know, to support people, you sort of reconsider the things you value. And having this moment when there are so many jobs open and not all of them are minimum wage jobs, when there are other options, or at least workers feel like there are other options for them, creates an opportunity for the first time for many people in years to say, you know what, I'm going to be brave to quit this thing I've been doing for a number of years. There is like still this mismatch between the jobs that are available and the folks who are not willing or able to take them. And another one I do want to mention is caretaking responsibilities. A lot of working parents say that they quit, not because they hated the job necessarily, but because they have to take care of kids and kids are not vaccinated and they're concerned for their health, or maybe they have someone elderly or someone with the immunocompromised health that they need to take care of. And so all of these, the working parents and working caretakers had to really reconsider. And they are the ones that are, I guess to use the term, being a bit left behind in this conversation, I feel like, quite a bit.
Thanks for that call, Troy, at 800-642-1234. Talking about people quitting their jobs, lots of people quitting their jobs. Alina Selyuk is with us from NPR. She's been following this story. Alina, one, I guess, easy solution people might think is, well, pay people more and they'll stick around or they'll come in. One quote struck me. I don't remember exactly who it was or what the quote was, but it was something to the effect of, you know, at this point, thinking about it, you couldn't pay me enough to come back and work at that place. Is that something you ran into a lot?
People do say that. It's important to remember that people often say things and then reality shows something different. So it's one of those things that personally I kind of take with a grain of salt, in the sense of yes, there are many people who are so burnt out and so stressed out and who have found better venues to work at, who would not return to their old jobs. But I think, you know, new doors would open for people if the, you know, it's a supply and demand sort of question, right? Like, for what amount of money would I be willing to do this job? But there's definitely, especially in the restaurant business, so many people just said, forget it.
Go back to our callers now. Anne is with us in central Wisconsin. Anne, hi.
Hi. I was working one job, and I just started in September after a few years being a stay-at-home mom. And then somebody I knew recruited me for their business, just offered me a job with much better pay and benefits, so I took that. So I'm one of the people that just started into the labor force again, but then I immediately switched jobs when I found something better.
And interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Some kind of the opposite in some ways of what we've heard, going from stay-at-home mom now into the workforce, and she's already finding a better-paying job, I guess, just a month in. I don't know. Are we going to see a lot of people hopping around, do you think, Alina?
I don't know. That one is a difficult question for me. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to tell. I don't know. I think a lot will depend on how the Delta concerns evolve, because again, a number of people, especially working parents and folks with sort of acute health concerns, are watching that with a lot of worry. Mm-hmm. And just to also put another number on it, at this moment, as of August, which is the latest data we have, I think the number of people who have just given up on job hunting is over 5 million. And the rates of unemployment recovery, so sort of people actually recovering their job losses, are particularly low for folks without college degrees and for women more than men, and especially for Black women. And so I think those are the fields I'm watching. As far as the job hopping, I don't know. They say one of the researchers I spoke with actually said that at least the younger generations of workers in most surveys say that they would like to stay with the same employer for 5 years or 10 years if they're treated well.
Thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Alina, what to you is the big unanswered question when it comes to this story of people quitting?
I think that's what I just brought up, which is what happens to those 5 million people who have given up. Will there be a switch that turns on that draws them back into this workforce? And how will companies address this major concern of women, working parents, and especially Black women whose unemployment numbers just have not recovered since pre-pandemic
Alina,
levels?
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alina Selyukh, business correspondent at NPR. She was with us today to talk about why the number of American workers quitting their jobs continues to be at an all-time high. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book examining the life and legacy of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Fannie Lou Hamer was a pivotal figure in the civil rights movement, but sometimes overlooked in popular history. Hamer was a sharecropper who lived in Mississippi and became an activist in her mid-40s for voting rights and Black political engagement. She's also the subject of a new book examining her lasting impact. Here's a listen to Hamer speaking on the UW-Madison campus in 1970.
I've been to jail. And I've been beaten in jail till my body was hard as metal. And I've been charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. And there's a lot of other young people throughout this country that has been beaten down. But I want you to know something in this audience today. A house divided against itself cannot stand. A nation divided against itself is on its way out. We are going to have to stand up and make demands that will make this country worthwhile.
Keisha N. Blaine is an author and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. She talked to WPR's J. Carlisle Larson earlier this month.
Let's look at Fannie Lou Hamer's life. What do we know about her life before she got involved in the civil rights movement?
Fannie Lou Hamer was born and grew up in Mississippi and spent most of her life working as a sharecropper. And so this is very important when you think about her involvement in the civil rights movement. Because she came from a very different background than many of the activists that are a lot more well-known. So very different background than someone like Martin Luther King Jr. or John Lewis or even Rosa Parks. And so when we think about her early life before she became involved in the movement, it's important to focused specifically on the challenges she endured living a life of poverty and working as a sharecropper in Mississippi.
And let's really quickly talk about just the legacy of sharecropping, because I think we hear about it as just, this is something that people did in the South without really looking at how brutal it could be, how it kept a lot of people in poverty.
Yes, this was a system that developed in the aftermath of slavery. And what's really unfortunate is when it comes to sharecropping, it ultimately allowed for Black people to remain in a system of poverty, certainly. Through sharecropping, one could not actually own property. And it meant that Black people would continue to give of their labor and not actually have much for themselves. So it was a system of exploitation that kept Black people in a never-ending cycle of debt and dependency.
Let's talk about how Fannie Lou Hamer really was turned on to voting, to the civil rights movement, because, as you said, she wasn't like John Lewis, who was involved in the early days. It was kind of a chance meeting. Is that correct?
Well, she became involved in the movement much later in life, at the age of 44. And this is significant because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, she spent her life working as a sharecropper, and in August of 1962 had an opportunity to attend a mass meeting. And this was a mass meeting that had been organized by activists in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And this was a transformative moment for her. She attended this mass meeting at a local church where she learned not only about the movement, but according to Hamer, that's where she learned about her rights, her voting rights as a citizen of the United States.
And I think that maybe many people listening might take that for granted, that there would be people out there who didn't know that they technically had the right to vote. But can you set the scene a little bit that the South at the time and in many other parts of the country didn't make it easy?
Absolutely. Hamer herself spoke about some of the challenges that she endured leading up to this moment and the context that ultimately made it difficult for her to know a lot of this information. So one of the things that she pointed out was how difficult it was being in a remote community, not necessarily being fully tapped into everything that was taking place, certainly on a national level. So that there's that, but also she did not have much formal education. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that Hamer ultimately spent much of her early life helping her family. And she obtained about a sixth grade education and did not have full exposure to a lot of the resources and information that many others would have had outside of this particular context of sharecropping. And so it's, in some ways it is surprising, but it also speaks to the lengths that white supremacists would go in this particular period to keep Black people, not only from the vote, but particularly even from access to quality education.
We are talking to Keisha N. Blaine right now. She's an author and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And we're talking about the life and legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, who was an integral part of the civil rights movement, but we don't always get to hear about her or learn about her. So let's continue looking at her involvement. So she goes to one of these mass meetings that was put on by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was in her mid-40s. She was a sharecropper and lived in Mississippi. As she got involved in this, in the civil rights campaign, particularly as it came to voting, you know, what was her involvement like?
Well, one of the things about Fannie Lou Hamer that I think is important to focus on is what I talk about in the book as her radical honesty. She was very vocal, never minced her words, always spoke boldly and passionately about what she cared about. So it's not ironic that it was actually her powerful speech in 1964 at the Democratic National Convention that ultimately catapulted her career. And so, as I mentioned, she was involved starting in 1962, and 2 years later, she gave this remarkable speech that was televised. So many people saw it. So many people were moved by it. And that was just one glimpse of how she contributed to the movement, always speaking truth to power.
And can we actually talk about that speech for a minute? Because it was at the DNC, it was before the Credentials Committee, and for President Lyndon Johnson at the time, she really, really scared him in some ways. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the White House responded when she went to speak at the committee?
Yes, well, it's important first to understand the context in thinking about why she was there in the first place. She played a pivotal role in establishing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And this was a step that ultimately shed light on the exclusion of Black people in the National Democratic Party. And so she made people uncomfortable from the minute she showed up with other members from the group, because they were there to ultimately demand representation, to demand that Black people have a say, have a voice, and representation. And it's not surprising that when she started speaking, it was clear that she was making a powerful impact. People were moved by her words. She spoke about racial violence. She spoke about state-sanctioned violence. She spoke about voter suppression, many of the challenges that she endured personally, but also the challenges that, other Black people were facing in Mississippi in particular, and across the South. And President Lyndon B. Johnson did not actually want to hear that. So he tried to block her speech. He interrupted, in fact, simply because I think it was clear to him, as it certainly was to so many others, that this was a speech that could change everything. This was a moment where people were not only being moved, but ultimately moved to act, that he knew that it would galvanize people to demand changes and radical changes quickly. And so that terrified him, as it terrified so many others.
We're listening back to a talk between WPR's J. Carlisle Larson and author Keisha Blaine, whose latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. We'll hear the rest of that conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're listening back to a talk with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson and historian Keisha Blaine. They talked about Blaine's new book, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America.
So let's talk to a little bit about what her experience was like. She, and I'm hitting this a lot because it's really important that she really stood at the intersection of a lot of things. She could speak to her experience living in poverty. She could speak to her experience as being a woman. She could importantly speak to her experience as being a Black woman. How did that ultimately resonate with people throughout the movement over the years?
I think it left a lasting impact. And one of the things that was so powerful about Hamer is that she just knew how to connect with people. People could relate to her. She just had this warm personality. And so there's so many different narratives that I encountered in the process of writing the book, of people talking about how they would visit her home, how she would welcome them in, how she would give them a plate of food, how she would sit with them and talk to them and listen to them. And I think part of that was made possible because of her unique experiences. She could relate to so many different people because of what she endured as a working poor Black woman, as a disabled activist in the South, as someone with limited formal education, right? There were so many aspects of her life that made her quite different than many of the other visible leaders in the movement. And that made a difference. People connected with her and they trusted her.
And if we could talk just for a minute too, she was disabled, and correct me if I'm wrong, she became disabled in part because of violence that she experienced as being part of the civil rights movement. Is that correct?
It is. She spoke about ultimately In her early life, one of the things that she talks about is contracting polio. So that's the first thing that's important to emphasize. But it is, in fact, a brutal beating that she endured in Winona, Mississippi in 1963 that exacerbated a limp and ultimately left her with a number of ailments, physical ailments that she carried for the rest of her life. And that certainly, I think, was important for her because she spoke about her experiences. She spoke about the brutal beating. I mentioned earlier about, you know, the how she really honed in on this idea of radical honesty. And that is true when it came to her painful experience of violence on multiple occasions.
One thing that has stood out to me in learning more about Fannie Lou Hamer was, you know, she was an activist. She advocated for voting rights. She advocated for better representation of Black Americans. And she also ran for office. Can you talk a little bit about why she ran for office and the impact it had?
Yes, this is so important because Fannie Lou Hamer, I think, just spent her life trying to devise strategies to improve lives, to improve the lives of everyone around her. Certainly committed to advancing Black political rights, but more broadly, she was committed to advancing the cause of human rights. One of the things that she emphasized was the importance of public service. And she tried. She ran for office three times total, was unsuccessful. But one of the things that she admitted was that even when she knew it was unlikely that she could win, it was still powerful. It was still meaningful for her to do it because she wanted to send a message to other people that Black people certainly could serve in office, could hold positions that would give them the ability to introduce policies and lead initiatives that could address social injustice. And so she tried throughout her lifetime to not only talk about the importance of Black political participation, but show through her example by running for office, even though she was unsuccessful.
So Dr. Blaine, one thing that I would like to touch on is just the role of, you know, Black women in particular in social justice movements. We have Fannie Lou Hamer as being this important figure in the civil rights movement, but today we don't always hear about her. We hear a lot about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Can you talk about Black women being centered in a lot of these movements?
Well, I think to this very day, mainstream narratives on the civil rights movement tend to be male-dominated narratives. And this is not to say that historians have not been writing about the significant role that women have played in the movement. We certainly have lots of great books on this topic, but there is still there is still this resistance, I think, on the mainstream level when we talk about the movement. There's this resistance to center women in particular, and it's somewhat, I think, shocking to me, because if we look at, for example, the Montgomery bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 is a moment in history that catapulted the career of Martin Luther King Jr. And we know him because that's the moment where he became involved in the Montgomery Improvement Association. That's when he became well-known on a national level. Of course, the actual boycott was started by Black women, a group of women in the Women's Political Council, individuals like Joanne Robinson. So I give that as an example to say that even when we identify Black men who are important leaders, clearly, in the struggle for civil rights, their experiences are not divorced from the significant contributions of Black women in the movement. It's impossible to talk about the civil rights movement without thinking about someone like Fannie Lou Hamer, without thinking about the work of, Ella Baker and, Septima Clark, and just so many others who, even if they were hidden from public view, not by choice, but oftentimes because they were pushed aside or marginalized in the movement, they were vital to shaping the movement as organizers and as leaders behind the scenes.
We are talking to Keisha N. Blaine right now, author and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And we are talking about the history of Fannie Lou Hamer and her role in the civil rights movement. And can you talk a little bit about how Fannie Lou Hamer first showed up for you as part of your education?
I first learned about Fannie Lou Hamer as a college student. And at the time, I had already declared a major in history. I was also pursuing a second major in Africana studies. And so I was primarily taking courses on the experiences of Black people in the US as well as globally. And in 2008, I was taking a course on the American Civil Rights Movement. And that's the first time that I learned about Hamer. I was surprised that it took me that long to find out about her because I just found her story so remarkable, so moving, so inspirational. And I could really relate to her. I could connect to her, you know, as someone coming from, you know, a working class background, as someone really trying to find my way at the time as a college student in a predominantly white institution. And finding Hamer, I think, was a moment that changed me, but it was surprising that it took so long to find out about her.
I want to talk about the title of your book for a second, because it's Until I Am Free, but the rest of what Fannie Lou Hamer said is, until I am free, you are not free either. Can you talk about how important that phrase was?
That phrase is so important, and it's exactly why I wanted to name the book Until I'm Free, because I felt like it was important for people to understand how much we are all connected. And this is part of Hamer's vision, her political vision of human rights, a vision that ultimately saw every single human as connected to the next. She wanted people to understand that if you are truly a part of the American polity, you cannot live your life without paying attention to what's taking place around you. You cannot live your life without paying attention to what is happening to other people in the United States. And I think this is a message that is so powerful. Of course, we know that not everyone embraces this message, but I think there is power in the message in knowing that our futures are connected. We may have different backgrounds. We have different experiences. Clearly, we have so many differences as people, but we are united through humanity. And when we fight for our freedom, we have to also be fighting for the freedom of others. So I think that that phrase encapsulates the power of unity, of solidarity. And certainly this is a message that we all need.
As a historian, Dr. Blaine, we've been talking about Fannie Lou Hamer's legacy in her life, but there's still a lot of history to learn. What do you want people to take away from this book?
I want people to leave this book with a clear sense of the power of the individual, to understand that one can make a difference in society, even with few material resources, even with limited access, even with limited formal education. I think we often focus on the things we don't have, but I hope that people read the book and think about ways they can contribute, think about ways they can make a difference using whatever skills and talents and abilities they have, and that we shift from excuses to solutions. I think that's the message that we find in Fannie Lou Hamer's story.
Dr. Blaine, thank you so much for talking to me today about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Keisha N. Blaine, author of the book Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. She talked to WPR's J. Carlisle Larson earlier this month. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, ecological challenges and climate change can have a big personal impact on people in the form of anxiety. Get advice on dealing with eco-anxiety. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, speaking of anxiety, we'll learn how we humans can actually work with the emotion of anxiety. In fact, we're wired that way. A neuroscientist explains all about good anxiety and offers strategies for figuring out what makes us anxious and how to have a positive response to it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.